Hi friends. I talk a lot about systems thinking on this podcast and thought I'd share one of the most potent actions you can take if you feel moved to be a different kind of leader for the 21st century. At Small Giants Academy, we developed our answer to the traditional MBA. We call it the MBE, a Mastery of Business and Empathy. The MBE is a truly groundbreaking program which equips leaders with the tools, strategies, networks, and philosophies to lead with purpose in these troubled times. Applications are open now for 2025, so head to smallgiants.com.au/MBE to learn more and sign up.
When people think about Nordic mythology, they will often say that, well, Nordic mythology is about the gods and the giants battling it out. And I think that's downright incorrect. The Nordic mythology is about the exact opposite. It is about the gods and the giants, forces of order and forces of chaos, being in relation.
Hi, I'm Barry, and this is the Wisdom in Action podcast, brought to you by the Small Giants Academy. Rune Rasmussen is a historian educated from the universities of Uppsala and Copenhagen as a historian of religion and a specialist on Nordic animism and shamanism. Animism kept coming up on our impact safari to Scandinavia, and it was a bit of a curveball, a bit of a curly, thrown in to spark the thinking around really ancient ways of being. Animism comes from the Latin anima, meaning breath, spirit, life. It is the belief that objects, places, and creatures all possess a distinct spiritual essence. Animism is used in anthropology of religion as a term for the belief system of many indigenous peoples, in contrast to the relatively more recent development of organized religions. The thing that really touched me about animism is the thing that Janine Benyus talks about in biomimicry, which is that rather than centering human beings in the story of life on Earth, we reweave ourselves back into a story of aliveness. So if the rivers are alive and we are alive, how are we when we are together? As Nora Bateson would ask, we're going to need more than our rational brain to map our way through this time. And I can't help dreaming into future ways of being in harmony with the planet and all life on Earth. So stay with me on this wild ride.
Hey, Barry, so nice to meet you again.
I'm really excited to have you on the podcast. I was really surprised and taken with your work and the incredible conversation that I had the privilege of witnessing in Copenhagen when we were together. And on that trip in Scandinavia, as you remember, we were talking about the meta crisis and the poly crisis and really deep diving on the systemic problems of our world. There was an energy in Scandinavia that was really quite amazing. And then your incredible conversation that night was kind of a turning point in a way for my own thinking. And I found that there was a thread through everything, a thread about animism. And you're the guy. So
thanks.
I would love if you could just tell our listeners who you are and what your life's work is devoted to and why.
I'm a historian of religion, and I sort of, during my education, I ended up having sort of two focuses, foci, where one is my own North European heritage and the other is anthropology. And I've been interested particularly in African culture and so on, or Afro-diasporic actually. So after my education, I basically started this project of saying, can we as people who are white, can we think about our own culture in the same way as contemporary indigenous peoples are thinking about their culture? And that then very quickly, I think, leads to a focus on animism, because part of what defines white people as white people and not, say, as Scottish or Gaels or Danes or whatever we all are. Part of the very definition is that animist culture is something that to a rather large extent has been pushed out of our culture. So that's the reason that I found that it was important to focus on animism. And I then created a platform called Nordic Animism, which is basically focusing on North European rejected animism, those kinds of culture that have been pushed out of our culture in that process where we became white, you could almost say that. Because obviously whiteness is something that has been, it's a cultural construction that in history has been imposed on us at some point.
You mean imposed like a homogenous overlay that kind of had nothing to do with the specificity of place and culture and language and practices? Would a good way of describing it be that it predates Christianity?
Partly, but it also undercuts Christianity. What you have is in Northern Europe is a long process of obviously changing culture, and Christianity is one step where, for instance, parts of animist culture starts becoming rejected. But another important step is actually modernity. If you read 19th century folklore scholars, then they describe the peasant communities of a place like Denmark or probably anywhere in Europe. They describe them as a delusional, infantile, barbaric animists. And so they're using exactly the same language that they would in the same period in the 19th century had been using to denigrate colonized peoples in other places in the world. So this is a self-colonization that's going on where we as a colonizer population are pointing the same aggressive tools towards ourselves in producing white people. And obviously, looking at that, you could see that as a decolonizing of ourselves as white people.
I mean, it was your PhD that was in Afro-Brazilian indigenous culture.
Yeah.
So what got you from there to turn the lens back on yourself and your own culture?
Yeah, that's a weird twist, isn't it?
Yeah.
part of the reason was that I studied an Afro-Brazilian religion, which is called Candomblé. It's kind of a kind of voodoo, actually, just from Brazil. And it has roots in a specific people in West Africa, which is called the Yoruba. And what I found fascinating about these people is that they seem to have this incredible capacity to create what you could almost call an animist safe space, even in these modern urban context where we live, where they're able to continuously reproduce their traditional animist culture in very dynamic, very powerful, and very current, very fresh ways. So part of my inspiration for thinking with this about Nordic culture in this way is like, well, they can do it. We can do it, like humans are humans.
So what's the point? Why this resurgence of interest in Nordic animism in particular? Like, you know, Viking culture was one of the sort of OG colonizing cultures, you know, rape, pillage and take over, which seems to be a big part of the human condition generally. But the Netflix shows on Viking culture, I feel like there's this kind of longing for mysticism, longing for that. It's not nostalgia because there's also this earthy, juicy, pre-patriarchal place for women in the culture. I don't know. I think maybe modern human beings, especially with our disconnect from our bodies and the planet, we're longing for. Am I in the right realm?
Yeah. I think the Viking as a contemporary cluster of imagery is very interesting. It has some very problematic sides to it.
Yes.
I think that the valorization of pre-Christian Scandinavia began at a point where the aggression was important. And that's part of basically saying we want an image of white people as these powerful colonizers. It was an aggressive part of history. But as a step in North European history that immediately precedes Christianity, part of what is interesting and I think attractive to many about Vikings is that we actually know quite a lot about their pre-Christian religion. We have some of their heathen poems and they are mind-blowing. They're crazy and they're difficult to read, and they have like complex poetic systems that that are very, very difficult to basically penetrate. And so we do know a lot about their pre-Christian religion, and that pre-Christian religion had aspects, for instance, of what is sometimes called shamanism, where particularly you had the figure of the völva, which is a female shaman. What's happening today is that many people in all over, I think, the world are basically turning towards earth-honoring modes of religiosity. So in Eastern Europe, Northern Europe, North America, you find this very strong inclination or turning towards paganism and witchcraft. And I think that that is a response to the growing realization that something is not working in the world and that we're moving towards a huge collapse in biodiversity and climate.
It felt amazing at our dinner conversation. It got very mystical. You were talking in beautiful ways. And what was incredible was that we had a really famous and beloved Australian Indigenous writer, thinker, and media personality there, Stan Grant. And as you were talking about Nordic animism, you and Stan started to have this incredible conversation about the similarities with Australian Indigenous wisdom and practice, and that there was overlap. And it's quite incredible if you think about the planet as a conscious context, to think about the different nodes on the planet where human beings were really tapping into some kind of deeper awareness and meaning making. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it has been incredibly fascinating to start learning about Aboriginal Australian thinking. It seems to me that Australia as a whole is very far ahead in sort of realizing we have a problem and reflecting on some of these things. And the Aboriginal Australians particularly, that was not something that I thought a lot about in my education. From the time I read Tyson Junker Porter, I started seeing that there are very deep-seated similarities. And there probably are that between many cultures around, well, you can find these similarities, but it was somehow surprising to me, I don't know, to just realize, wow, Aboriginal Australian, for instance, they have this idea that law comes from the land. So you are in a kinship relation with totemic others that inhabit the land. And then out of those relations grow those laws from which you build a human society. So you build a human community basically out of the laws of transformation and processes that are in the land. And then I realized that one of the main proverbs about law in Scandinavia, it is understood to say, on laws we shall build our nation. But if you translate the old Icelandic version, it can also mean, with law we shall inhabit the landscapes. It has become very popular because it kind of rings a little bit of patriotism and these kind of things. But what it actually means, or part of its meaning, that through law, we inhabit our landscapes. So looking at stuff like fairy tales and old legends and culture, you find that stuff like totemic kinship relation between humans and others in the land is actually something that's been here a lot.
Were you meaning in different seasons? Like, how does the law of the landscape, like, take it down onto the ground for me? What does that look like? What does that feel like? What does that mean?
Well, obviously it's different in different cultures. And in some cultures, you've had basically entire different social structure. There's specific Indigenous Americans where during the summer, they basically lived in what would look like a state. And then during winter, they would split up and live in little hunter bands. So their very society as a structure is breathing with the seasons of the land, right? In Northern Europe, you have, for instance, the idea that harvest starts at a certain point in late July, early August, and then it runs until late September. And that's 2 months. During that period, there is they call it a bond of peace, actually. There's peace on the land, which means that you can't actually perform specific legislations and so on.
It's so mythopoetic and beautiful. And I'm like, yes, we need to do that again. And then that there's that nostalgia, and you can get caught in the nostalgic, romantic place. And I'm looking for interventions now. I want to know how the work that you're doing is being felt and how it can be applied in this very modern moment as a healing meaning-making tool.
I think that romanticism at some level defines all of us. I totally think that you're right, that there is a danger in romanticism for becoming nostalgic, because the nostalgia is something that is far removed. I don't think that for these people who held a bond of peace around the harvest or something similar around Yule, Christmas, I don't think for them that that was a pretty nostalgic thing. It was the way the world worked. It was participating in the machinery of the world. Romanticism has this amazing image. You see it in the Avatar movies. It's like 3 meters tall, like weird blue space indigenes who have neural plugs in their long hair that they can plug into the mycelium of Mother Earth. It's like, it's so incredibly distant, this vision. It's not close to us. And I think that bringing this stuff close is important. Addressing that is not easy. And I don't have a solution to all that. I don't have like the answer. But one example is to try to be playful in the approach to traditional culture.
I love that. And I didn't expect this to come up, but when you were inviting some kind of solstice festival in 2023, you said inviting all non-racist Scandinavians to celebrate this solstice. Why do you have to keep saying inviting all non-racist? Like, how does this become perverse quickly?
I think it is inherent to dealing with Eurodescendant culture, that you can never really turn your eye away from it. Most Euro-traditional culture has some level been implicated in bad stuff. Some of it we have to face, and that is part of that decolonizing process where we say, okay, well, there is bad stuff in this, but we're looking at it, we're dealing with it in that process. Now, that's part of the reason that I rarely do anything without somehow flagging that there is an anti-racist position that this is coming from and going to.
What was kind of compelling to me is that so many people feel so guilty, like the culture wars and identity politics and how this is all playing out in the human collective is that people are at war with themselves and each other. It's quite the opposite of connectivity. I don't think I've ever lived in a time with so much disconnect, such profound disconnect. And a lot of it is around huge guilt on this discussion about indigeneity and belonging. And there's the idea of oppressor, oppressed, colonizer, colonized. And it's such a kind of crushing weight of wrestling with these big ideas that it's become, it's war. It's the opposite of connectivity. And I was saying that I really feel like your work and the things that you're pointing to are how we can step aside from those mechanisms. Those are not the tools of healing and reparation. And you were saying something really amazing about guilt.
When we talk about how white people understand themselves today, there's some very serious problems in seeing ourselves as irredeemably damned, that there is no possible path forward as a having a positive self-understanding as a Euro-descendant person in, for instance, a diaspora situation in a colonized continent like Australia. And I think that the guilt is part of a horrid complex of actually Protestant ideas. So the Protestant ideas is that we are irredeemably damned. So we should feel guilt about our deeply perverted nature. Then we receive redemption from the unending grace of God. That means we are irredeemably damned.
Yeah, therein lies salvation.
Yeah. So the problem with that is that it puts humanity simultaneously in eternal irredeemable damnation and being forgiven and redeemed anyway.
I think that is a cognitive dissonance. I don't think it's a coincidence that exactly that cognitive dissonance has defined many of those people who are responsible, for instance, for colonizing and a disproportionate amount of immoral behavior. So reproducing white guilt is just a really, really bad idea. You should not feel guilt for what your ancestors did. Perhaps you should feel responsible for being inscribed in systems of privilege and how you handle that, but that's a very different thing. It's a very different thing. We must point paths towards other kinds of self-image, other cultural identifications that are not basically built on the foundations that have created the colonial reality.
So with animism and talking about Nordic folk tradition and your work, folk traditions feel like reclaiming something magical and necessary and medicinal. And so what is the medicine as you understand it?
As I understand it, the medicine is recovering connectivity in a number of different parameters. One thing would be just recovering connectivity between humans. The contemporary system has this tendency of wanting to isolate humans. We need to live in these little cells, these little apartments where we're all sitting with our television screens in front of us, and we're not out there basically organizing activist groups and anarchist communes and whatever, all these things. So one thing is building connectivity between humans. Another thing is building connectivity between humans and the land. And that means connectivity between us and the seasons, connectivity between us and the others in the land, meaning animals, and also connectivity between us and spirit beings. So there's a whole package of connectivity that I think animism can unlock or point out us in the direction of.
In listening to you, I'm relating it mostly even to myself, because I use my brain a lot. I use many forms of capital that I have to try and pierce and create or find interventions that are like acupressure points in the system, you know? And that's what we're all hunting for. I love what you're saying about finding the stories that are real healing interventions, and the idea that they're our ancient stories, traditional culture, rituals, rites of passage, reweaving ourselves back into cyclical awareness, cyclical calendars, thinking about time differently. There is so much richness there. Oh, that's what we were talking about in Scandinavia, talking about the superficial reading of a story like The Little Mermaid, or we were talking about Ragnarok. You had this amazing interpretation of Ragnarok and what it was supposed to be about and the giants and the humans. Can you just say a little bit about that?
Totally. When people think about Nordic mythology, they will often say that, well, Nordic mythology is about the gods and the giants battling it out. And I think that's downright incorrect. Often it is the idea that you see represented in popular culture. The Nordic mythology is about the exact opposite. It is about the gods and the giants, forces of order and forces of chaos, being in relation. And that's what it is unfolded and developed in all kinds of ways in the Nordic mythology. These relations are not necessarily all like kumbaya pretty. Sometimes they're problematic and seductive and abusive. There's all kinds of relation. But the Ragnarok is the collapse of this network of relation where the gods and the giants start basically battling each other. Social coherence and ecology collapses. The Ragnarok myth might be inspired by the actual experience of climate change in Scandinavia, which hit in the mid-6th century, where global cooling caused a particularly harsh decline in human condition. And the Ragnarok is a myth that emerged not so long time after that. So it's probably inspired by this experience of climate change. This makes the Ragnarok myth, I think, one of the most urgent myths of our day. It speaks so powerfully into our time. And that's part of the reason that it's being narrated so much. And what should really be the point of talking about the Ragnarok is to have it as something of what the Aboriginal Australians often call a cautionary tale. It is talking about the actual total collapse. And I think you're totally right that the way that we engage today, these kinds of stories are really, really important. And they can totally be engaged in the wrong ways. Like, for instance, it was the case with the Ragnarok series on Netflix, which basically narrated that the ecological collapse is the fault of the giants. It's basically saying it's not the fault of humanity that the world is collapsing. It is the fault of the forces of nature. It is the exact opposite. So that is a very dangerous way of applying a very powerful language. This is mythology. It's a powerful language. And I think that it's a big mistake that many contemporary, for instance, filmmakers, they think about this as not essentially different than, say, Donald Duck. It's like it's just a story. It's just an interesting story. It's not. These are stories that narrate relation. That I think that's what myth is. A myth is a story that narrate relation between people. So the story that America is a great nation, that's a myth. It creates relation between people, sometimes in good ways, sometimes in bad ways, but it creates relation. Freedom is important in Western civilization. It's a myth. Such an idea can even start wars. And I think that when we're talking about these old stories, it's incredibly important that this engagement is done in the right way. The story about the Ragnarok, for instance, we could see that as the inevitability of a total, bloody, horrid, cruel collapse that is coming our way. That's not a story that has a lot of hope in it. But what if we engage it as a cautionary tale? This is a cautionary tale. There is a deep traditional knowledge of the consequences of rupture in the world that is layered in our reality. We learn something about our reality by listening to that kind of story. And one thing is that the collapse that is being cautioned against seem to be in the process of manifesting now, but perhaps there's always hope. In the Nordic mythology, Odin doesn't just give up and say, okay, so Ragnarok is inevitable, so we better just, you know, sit down and, I don't know, smoke pot and listen to Jordan Peterson. We are in a struggle. The real fight is to recover relation and recover that engagement. We can be realized as people whose descendants can actually be proud of us. We need to become descendants, ancestors that our descendants can be proud of. And part of that is through right engagement with stories like that, like the Ragnarok.
I love it. I think there's so much medicine in this conversation, and we could talk for hours about these layers. So thank you for your work.
Thanks a lot for bringing me on here. Super nice to hang out with you again.
My mind is still swirling as I'm integrating Runa's work. I think that these ancient cultures with their rites of passage, their rituals, their codes, their laws for how to work seasonally, relationally with each other, with their animals, with the earth, it's still such a potent source of medicine for us now. Connection. It's all about connection. And that's what I keep coming back to. So what are the ways that we can weave ourselves back to connection? Yeah, my mind is swirling. I'm totally curious to know what you all thought of that amazing conversation with Runa Rasmussen. It's a bold project, but one that is full of possibility that we might be able to carve out ancient futures informed by deep wisdom from the past.
This was the Wisdom in Action podcast, brought to you by the Small Giants Academy. If you want to turn this wisdom into action, go to smallgiants.com.au for more information about the programs we run. We love hearing from you. So tell us what you think by leaving a rating and review on your favorite podcast app or email us at podcast@smallgiants.com.au.